This is Steve Lord from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'm going to be reading four short pieces of literature from the Christmas season. I hope you enjoy them. The Elves and the Shoemaker by the Brothers Grimm is a classic Brothers Grimm fairy tale about a down-on-his-luck shoemaker who receives some unexpected help, in this case from three young elves. Dating back to 1806, The Elves and the Shoemaker is a story about the virtues of generosity and the rewards of hard work. The Elves and the Shoemaker, from the Brothers Grimm. A shoemaker, by no fault of his own, had become so poor that at last he had nothing left but leather for one pair of shoes. So in the evening, he cut out the shoes which he wished to begin to make the next morning, and as he had a good conscience, he lay down quietly in his bed, commended himself to God, and fell asleep. In the morning, after he had said his prayers and was just going to sit down to work, the two shoes stood quite finished on his table. He was astounded and knew not what to say to it. He took the shoes in his hands to observe them closer, and they were so neatly made that there was not one bad stitch in them, just as if they were intended as a masterpiece. Soon after, a buyer came in, and as the shoes pleased him so well, he paid more for them than was customary. And with the money, the shoemaker was able to purchase leather for two pairs of shoes. He cut them out at night, and next morning was about to set to work with fresh courage. But he had no need to do so, for when he got up, they were already made, and buyers also were not wanting, who gave him money enough to buy leather for four pairs of shoes. The following morning, too, he found the four pairs made, and so it went on constantly. What he had cut out in the evening was finished by the morning, so that he soon had his honest independence again, and at last became a wealthy man. Now it befell that one evening, not long before Christmas, when the man had been cutting out, he said to his wife before going to bed, "What think you if we were to stay up tonight to see who it is that lends us this helping hand?" The woman liked the idea, and lighted a candle, and then they hid themselves in a corner of the room, behind some clothes which were hanging up there, and watched. When it was midnight, two pretty little naked men came, sat down by the shoemaker's table, took all the work which was cut out before them, and began to stitch and sew and hammer so skillfully and so quickly with their little fingers that the shoemaker could not turn away his eyes for astonishment. They did not stop until all was done and stood finished on the table, and they ran quickly away. Next morning the woman said, "The little men have made us rich, and we really must show that we are grateful for it. They run about so and have nothing on and must be cold. I'll tell thee what I'll do. I will make them little shirts and coats and vests and trousers, and knit both of them a pair of stockings, and do thou too make them two little pairs of shoes." The man said, "I shall be very glad to do it." And one night, when everything was ready, they laid their presents all together on the table instead of the cut-out work, and then concealed themselves to see how the little men would behave. At midnight they came bounding in and wanted to get to work at once. But as they did not find any leather cut out, but only the pretty little articles of clothing, they were at first astonished, and then they showed intense delight. They dressed themselves with the greatest rapidity, putting the pretty clothes on and singing, "Now we are boys so fine to see, why should we longer cobblers be?" Then they danced and skipped and leapt over chairs and benches. At last they danced out of doors. From that time forth they came no more. But as long as the shoemaker lived, all went well with him, and all his undertakings prospered. In the deeply moving poem, Amazing Peace, Maya Angelou implores humanity to embrace the peace and promise of Christmas. Read by the poet at the lighting of the National Christmas Tree at the White House on December 1, 2005, Amazing Peace asks how we can look beyond complexion and see community. Amazing Peace, a Christmas poem by Dr. Maya Angelou. Thunder rumbles in the mountain passes, and lightning rattles the eaves of our houses. Flood waters await us in our avenues. Snow falls upon snow, falls upon snow to avalanche over unprotected villages. The sky slips low and gray and threatening. We question ourselves, what have we done to so affront nature? We worry God. Are you there? Are you there really? Does the covenant you made with us still hold? Into this climate of fear and apprehension, Christmas enters. Streaming lights of joy, ringing bells of hope, and singing carols of forgiveness high up in the bright air. The world is encouraged to come away from rancor, come the way of friendship. It is the glad season. Thunder ebbs to silence, and lightning sleeps quietly in the corner. Flood waters recede into memory. Snow becomes a yielding cushion to aid us as we make our way to higher ground. Hope is born again in the faces of children. It rides on the shoulders of our aged as they walk into their sunsets. Hope spreads around the earth, brightening all things, even hate, which crouches breeding in dark corridors. In our joy, we think we hear a whisper. At first it is too soft, then only half heard. We listen carefully as it gathers strength. We hear a sweetness. The word is peace. It is loud now. It is louder, louder than the explosion of bombs. We tremble at the sound. We are thrilled by its presence. It is what we have hungered for, not just the absence of war, but true peace, a harmony of spirit, a comfort of courtesies, security for our beloveds and their beloveds. We clasp hands and welcome the peace of Christmas. We beckon this good season to wait a while with us. We, Baptist and Buddhist, Methodist and Muslim, say, come, peace. Come and fill us and our world with your majesty. We, the Jew and the Jainist, the Catholic and the Confucian, implore you to stay a while with us, so we may learn by your shimmering light how to look beyond complexion and see community. It is Christmas time, a halting of hate time. On this platform of peace, we can create a language to translate ourselves to others and to each other. At this holy instant, we celebrate the birth of Jesus Christ into the great religions of the world. We jubilate the precious advent of trust. We shout with glorious tongues at the coming of hope. All the earth's tribes loosen their voices to celebrate the promise of peace. We, angels and mortals, believers and non-believers, look heavenward and speak the word aloud. Peace. We look at our world and speak the word aloud. Peace. We look at each other, then into ourselves, and we say without shyness or apology or hesitation, peace, my brother. Peace, my sister. Peace, my soul. The 12 Terrors of Christmas by John Updike is an off-kilter look at Christmas traditions. This decidedly non-traditional take on the holiday is sure to tickle the funny bone of even the most cynical Scrooge. The 12 Terrors of Christmas by John Updike. Number 1. Santa the Man. Loose-fitting nylon beard. Fake optical twinkle. Cheap red suit. Funny rummy smell when you sit on his lap. If he's such a big shot, why is he drawing unemployment for 11 months of the year? Something scary and off-key about him, like one of those Stephen King clowns. Number two, Santa, the concept. Why would anybody, halfway normal, want to live at the North Pole on a bunch of shifting ice floes? Or stay up all night flying around the sky distributing presents to children of doubtful deservingness? There's a point where altruism becomes sick, or else a sinister cover-up for an international scam. A man of no plausible address, with no apparent source for his considerable wealth, comes down the chimney after midnight while decent law-abiding citizens are snug in their bed. Is this not, at the least, cause for alarm? Number three, Santa's helpers. Again, what is really going on? Why do these purported elves submit to sweatshop conditions in what must be one of the gloomiest climates in the world, unless they are getting something out of it at our expense? Underclass masochism one day, bloody rebellion the next. The rat-a-tat-tat of tiny hammers may be just the beginning. Number four, O Tannenbaum. Suppose it topples over under its weight of bomb-shaped bowels. Suppose it harbors wood borers, which will migrate to the furniture. There is something ghastly about a tree, its look of many-limbed paralysis, its shaggy and conscienceless aplomb, encountered in the open, let alone in the living room. At night, you can hear it rustling and slurping water out of the bucket. Number five, tiny reindeer. Hooves that cut through roof shingles like linoleum knives. Unstable flight patterns, suggesting to at least one observer, dry leaves that before the wild hurricane fly. Fur possibly laden with disease-bearing ticks. Number six, electrocution. It's not just the frayed strings of lights anymore, or the corroded transformer of the plucky little Lionel. It's all those battery packs, those electronic games, those built-in dictionaries, those robots a-sizzle with artificial intelligence. Even the tinsel tingles this year. And isn't it somehow terrible, the way shed tinsel shivers in the gloomy, ice-clogged gutters? Number seven, the carols. They boom and chime from the vaulted ceilings of supermarkets and discount malls. And yet the spirits keep sinking. Have our hearts grown so terribly heavy since childhood? What has happened to us? Why don't they ever play our favorites? What were our favorites? Tum-ti-dum-tum, angels on high, something-something sky. Number eight, the specials. Was Charlie Brown's voice always so plaintive and grating? Did Bing Crosby always have that little potbelly and walk with his toes out? Wasn't that Danny Kaye, Fred Astaire, Jimmy Stewart, Grinch, a card? Is Vera Ellen still alive? Isn't there something else on, like wrestling or Easter Parade? Number nine, fear of not giving enough. Leads to dizziness in shopping malls, foot fractures on speeded up escalators, thumb and wrist sprain in the course of package manipulation, eye and facial injuries in carton crowded buses, and fluttering sensations of disorientation and imminent impoverishment. Number 10, fear of not receiving enough. Leads to anxious scanning of UPS deliveries and to identity crises on Christmas morning as the piles of rumpled wrapping paper and emptied boxes mount higher around every chair but your own. Three dull neckties and a pair of flannel-lined work gloves. Is this really how they see you? Number 11. Fear of returns. The embarrassments, the unseemly haggling, the lost receipts, the allegations of damaged goods, the humiliating descent into mercantilism's boiler room. Number 12. The Dark. Oh, how early it comes now. How creepy and green in the gills everyone looks, scrabbling along in drab winter wraps by the phosphorus light of department store windows full of styrofoam snow, mock-ups of a facetious 1890, and beige mannequins posed with false jauntiness in plaid bathrobes. Is this hell, or just an upturn in consumer confidence? Originally published in 1851, Charles Dickens wrote What Christmas Is As We Grow Older as a short essay after the deaths of his father and daughter. While suggesting that Christmas should be a time of gratitude and forgiveness, Dickens notes how the excitement of the holiday can curdle into bitterness in later life. What Christmas Is As We Grow Older by Charles Dickens. Time was, with most of us, when Christmas Day, encircling all our limited world like a magic ring, left nothing out for us to miss or seek, bound together all our home enjoyments, affections, and hopes, grouped everything and everyone around the Christmas fire, and made the little picture shining in our bright young eyes complete. Time came, perhaps all so soon, when our thoughts overleaped that narrow boundary, when there was someone, very dear, we thought then, very beautiful and absolutely perfect, wanting to the fullness of our happiness. When we were wanting to, or we thought so, which did just as well, at the Christmas hearth by which that someone sat, and when we intertwined with every wreath and garland of our life that someone's name. That was the time for the bright visionary Christmases which have long arisen from us to show faintly after summer rain in the palest edges of the rainbow. That was the time for the beatified enjoyment of the things that were to be and never were, and yet the things that were so real in our resolute hope that it would be hard to say now what realities achieved since have been stronger. What? Did that Christmas never really come when we and the priceless pearl who was our young choice were received, after the happiest of totally impossible marriages, by the two united families previously at daggers drawn on our account? When brothers and sisters-in-law, who had always been rather cool to us before our relationship was affected, perfectly doted on us, and when fathers and mothers overwhelmed us with unlimited incomes? Was that Christmas dinner never really eaten, after which we arose and generously and eloquently rendered honor to our late rival, present in the company, then and there exchanging friendship and forgiveness, and founding an attachment not to be surpassed in Greek or Roman story, which subsisted until death? Has that same rival long ceased to care for that same priceless pearl, and married for money, and become usurious? Above all, do we really know now that we should probably have been miserable if we had won and worn the pearl, and that we are better without her? That Christmas, when we had recently achieved so much fame, when we had been carried in triumph somewhere for doing something great and good, when we had won an honored and ennobled name, and arrived and were received at home in a shower of tears of joy, is it possible that that Christmas has not yet come? And is our life here, at the best, so constituted that, pausing as we advance at such a noticeable milestone in the track as this great birthday, we look back on the things that never were, as naturally and full as gravely as on the things that have been and are gone, or have been and still are? If it be so, and so it seems to be, must we come to the conclusion that life is little better than a dream, and little worth the loves and strivings that we crowd into it? No! Far be such miscalled philosophy from us, dear reader, on Christmas Day. Nearer and closer to our hearts be the Christmas spirit, which is the spirit of active usefulness, perseverance, cheerful discharge of duty, kindness, and forbearance. It is in the last virtues especially that we are, or should be, strengthened by the unaccomplished visions of our youth. For who shall say that they are not our teachers to deal gently even with the impalpable nothings of the earth? Therefore, as we grow older, let us be more thankful that the circle of our Christmas associations and of the lessons that they bring expands. Let us welcome every one of them and summon them to take their places by the Christmas hearth. Welcome, old aspirations, glittering creatures of an ardent fancy, to your shelter underneath the holly. We know you and have not outlived you yet. Welcome, old projects and old loves, however fleeting, to your nooks among the steadier lights that burn around us. Welcome, all that was ever real to our hearts, and for the earnestness that made you real, thanks to heaven. Do we build no Christmas castles in the clouds now? Let our thoughts, fluttering like butterflies among these flowers of children, bear witness. Before this boy there stretches out a future, brighter than we ever looked on in our old romantic time, but bright with honor and with truth. Around this little head on which the sunny curls lie heaped, the graces sport as prettily, as airily, as when there was no scythe within the reach of time to shear away the curls of our first love. Upon another girl's face near it, placider but smiling bright, a quiet and contented little face, we see home fairly written. Shining from the word as rays shine from a star, we see how, when our graves are old, other hopes than ours are young. Other hearts than ours are moved, how other ways are smoothed, how other happiness blooms, ripens, and decays. No, not decays, for other homes and other bands of children, not yet in being, nor for ages yet to be, arise and bloom and ripen to the end of all. Welcome everything. Welcome alike what has been and what never was, and what we hope may be, to your shelter underneath the holly, to your places round the Christmas fire, where what is sits open-hearted. In yonder shadow do we see obtruding furtively upon the blaze an enemy's face? By Christmas Day do we forgive him. If the injury he has done us may admit of such companionship, let him come here and take his place. If otherwise, unhappily, let him go hence, assured that we will never injure nor accuse him. On this day we shut out nothing. Pause, says a low voice. Nothing? Think. On Christmas Day we will shut out from our fireside nothing. Not the shadow of a vast city where the withered leaves are lying deep, the voice replies. Not the shadow that darkens the whole globe. Not the shadow of the city of the dead. Not even that. Of all days in the year, we will turn our faces towards that city upon Christmas Day, and from its silent hosts bring those we loved among us. City of the dead, in the blessed name wherein we are gathered together at this time, and in the presence that is here among us, according to the promise we will receive, and not dismiss, thy people who are dear to us. Yes, we can look upon these children angels that alight so solemnly, so beautifully among the living children by the fire, and can bear to think how they departed from us. Entertaining angels unawares, as the patriarchs did, the playful children are unconscious of their guests, but we can see them, can see a radiant arm around one favorite neck, as if there were a tempting of that child away. Among the celestial figures there is one, a poor misshapen boy on earth, of a glorious beauty now, of whom his dying mother said it grieved her much to leave him here, alone, for so many years, as it was likely would elapse before he came to her, being such a little child. But he went quickly, and was laid upon her breast, and in her hand she leads him. There was a gallant boy who fell far away upon a burning sand beneath a burning sun, and said, tell them at home with my last love how much I could have wished to kiss them once, but that I died contented and had done my duty. Or there was another over whom they read the words, "Therefore we commit his body to the deep," and so consigned him to the lonely ocean and sailed on. Or there was another who lay down to his rest in the dark shadow of great forests, and on earth awoke no more. Oh, shall they not from sand and sea and forest be brought home at such a time? There was a dear girl, almost a woman, never to be one, who made a mourning Christmas in a house of joy and went her trackless way to the silent city. Do we recollect her, worn out, faintly whispering what could not be heard, and falling into that last sleep for weariness? Oh, look upon her now! Oh, look upon her beauty, her serenity, her changeless youth, her happiness! The daughter of Jairus was recalled to life, to die. But she, more blessed, has heard the same voice, saying unto her, "Arise forever." We had a friend who was our friend from early days, with whom we often pictured the changes that were to come upon our lives, and merrily imagined how we would speak and walk and think and talk when we came to be old. His destined habitation in the city of the dead received him in his prime. Shall he be shut out from our Christmas remembrance? Would his love have so excluded us? Lost friend, lost child, lost parent, sister, brother, husband, wife, we will not so discard you. You shall hold your cherished places in our Christmas hearts and by our Christmas fires, and in the season of immortal hope and on the birthday of immortal mercy, we will shut out nothing. The winter sun goes down over town and village. On the sea it makes a rosy path, as if the sacred tread were fresh upon the water. A few more moments and it sinks, and night comes on, and lights begin to sparkle in the prospect. On the hillside beyond the shapelessly diffused town, and in the quiet keeping of the trees that gird the village steeple, remembrances are cut in stone, planted in common flowers, growing in grass, entwined with lowly brambles around many a mound of earth. In town and village there are doors and windows closed against the weather. There are flaming logs leaped high. There are joyful faces. There is healthy music of voices. Be all ungentleness and harm excluded from the temples of the household gods. But be those remembrances admitted with tender encouragement. They are of the time and all its comforting and peaceful reassurances, and of the history that reunited, even upon earth, the living and the dead, and of the broad beneficence and goodness that too many men have tried to tear to narrow shreds. And that's it for our Christmas stories. I hope you've enjoyed them. I'm Steve Lord, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138.